All right, we are live here with a Schloss rant from the Philadelphia suburbs. We're recording this on Tuesday night, March 28th. The Final Four is set, and I just finished watching a little bit of the NIT with North Texas and Wisconsin. Interesting ending. Wisconsin goes scoreless for 9 minutes, and the reason I'm really into this game is because I can't stand Wisconsin, obviously, from those Arizona losses in 14 and 15. So, yes, even in the NIT, to see those guys go scoreless for about 9-plus minutes to end the game puts a little joy in my heart, puts a little pep in my step as I'm about to break down the real Final Four. We'll touch on Major League Baseball, some teams that I like for the season, some teams I don't like for the season. We'll talk about the new rules, and we'll touch on the Knicks real quick to end the show as well. But let's get right into the Final Four. And the story that everyone's talking about with the Final Four came from one of the Elite Eight games, Creighton and San Diego State. And I know I'm late to this. I know this was all over First Take, every sports talk radio station probably in the country, definitely on the ones that I listen to with WFAN and Mad Dog Sports Radio on Sirius. The referee cannot make that call, period, stop. It's a tie game. The teams have played almost 40 minutes to that point. The referee has got to let that game go to overtime. There have only been 22 fouls called in the game so far. Reffing shouldn't be 100% consistent the entire game. It's got to be situational, meaning you can recover from a foul at the 8 minute mark of the first half. You can't recover from a foul call with less than 2 seconds left. It's not right. It's not fair. It's ticky tack. Unless it's blatantly obvious and the guy's shoving him under his armpits, slaps his wrist, shoves his shoulder, something like that, where the shooter is affected, you got to swallow the whistle. You can't make that type of call if you're the ref. Because these games, they impact legacies. They impact coaching and recruiting. So you can't make that call there. And I think even to look at it from the fans' perspective and the viewers' perspective, we don't want to see the refs get involved to change it. For me, it leaves me unsatisfied knowing that the Final Four, I'm not going to say it was 100% because of that call, but it sure helped San Diego State go up at the end of the game. So I don't like that. And I also don't like, and I know this has been talked about, these referee analysts coming in and not criticizing the referee who made that call there. I'm talking to you, Gene Steratore. Because you're on all season with CBS, with football, the NFL. You're on all season long March Madness with college basketball. Just say that the ref got it wrong. Stop defending him. Could this have, been technically by the letter of law if you're a referee tactician? Yeah, of course. But was it egregious enough where it's totally altering his shot? No, it is not. So you got to let it go. It's unsatisfying. It's not right. And reffing, again, like I said, doesn't need to be consistent. There's different situations that call for different calls. And in that spot, you let it go to overtime. Now, to talk about the actual participants in the Final Four, because I thought I had to lead off with that and make my point, rock solid. And I think I did. But I like that one of these Final Four matchups, of course, with UConn and Miami and San Diego State and FAU. But I like that San Diego State is playing FAU because I think it's good that you get the two non-Power 5 / non-Big East schools. I think that it takes away the opportunity for there to be a total blowout because, UConn and Miami, those would be the teams that you would expect to blow out, these next level, lower tier schools like FAU and San Diego State in this Final Four. So You know, could that lead to the championship game on Monday being bad? Maybe, but you know what? I got to be honest. When it comes to the Final Four, I'm more into the Saturday games than the championship game itself. That might be, you know, differing from most, but I prefer, and again, what I love about the NCAA tournament, I prefer having the games back-to-back. It gives me a little feel for all the teams. The championship game, all right, you get some exciting games. You get 2016 Villanova winning, you know, the crazy shot. You get even 2017 North Carolina beating Gonzaga. I think that was a pretty good game, but I don't remember all the specifics. You know, even you go back to 1997 and the Arizona Wildcats winning in overtime. You know, that's pretty exciting. 08, you got Memphis Kansas beating Memphis. Yeah, it comes down to the wire. You might get an exciting game, but I like the multiple games on the multiple night on the same night, I should say, because it's more of an event, more exciting. So at any rate, having the two non-traditional Power Five teams playing each other, I think is great. And then of course you get Miami and you get UConn, and UConn has been, you know, pretty much the best team the entire tournament, winning in pretty convincing fashion, especially in that Elite Eight game against Gonzaga, who they just, I mean, they didn't make it look like Gonzaga belonged on the same court or the same stadium or really even the same state as UConn. And, you know, as an Arizona alum, Gonzaga is kind of one of our quote-unquote rivals. Makes me happy because that team gets to play in that, you know, West Coast Conference. And it's seemingly every game they're up by 35 points and everyone's all clapping on the side and Fuse clapping on the side. And, of course, Arizona's got the connection with Tommy Lloyd, who was one of their former assistants. But I don't particularly care for Gonzaga, even though I think, you know, Mark Few's done a good job to get his team in the tournament, you know, 25-plus years, whatever it is. But seeing them lose to UConn on the side, you know, definitely warmed up my heart a little bit too. Seeing FAU, though, let's get back to that game, the FAU-San Diego State. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a fun, interesting matchup, and I'll give you a pick a little bit later. But to talk about FAU, some things that people might not know. They've got a 2,700-person gym. That's it. That's all that they see. You look at these bigger college programs, Kentucky, again, to keep using Arizona. But, you know, they're seating 16, 17, 18, 19,000, whatever it is. This is much smaller. They've got little to no NIL money. Until recently, and this is according to Evan Cohen on the Mad Dog Sports Radio, Sirius XM, The Morning Men. He was there for 6 years as their play-by-play guy. He was on a local station, ESPN West Palm, forever, I think up until pretty recently. And, you know, he said basically until this tournament run started, they didn't have any NIL money coming in. So I'm going to take his word on that because people have been talking, oh, with the NIL money, players can go anywhere and it makes it more equal. No, I think this is just a situation where FAU has shot the ball really well and they have a pretty darn good coach. And another thing with FAU, they have only one guy in their radio booth. Pretty unheard of. Usually you got a play-by-play person and also an analyst. And I've driven by this school, probably over 100 times in my life with grandparents being down there in Boca, my parents being down there now in the Boynton Beach, Lake Worth area, a little bit north of Boca, closer to West Palm Beach. And if you would have told me that school would be going to the Final Four, I wouldn't have believed you and I'd laugh at you. So just unbelievable job by them to even make it this far. And prior to this season, they hadn't even won a tournament game. So it just goes to highlight how unlikely of a story. And my dad went to one of their games this year and he's like, oh, they're pretty good. And I took that to be, all right, maybe they'll win their conference. Maybe they'll win a game in the tournament. And they were seeded in the ninth place because they did win over 30 games in the regular season. Or they won 30 and they, or maybe whatever it was, they won about 30 games in the regular season. So it goes to show you they've been able to capture their winning all year and continue it on in this NCAA tournament. And you look at their coach, Dusty May. This is what I love about sports. He has been grinding away at this thing since 2000. Working video assistant jobs, I think, at Indiana, where he graduated, where he's a student manager. And then finally not getting a head coaching job until 2018 with, of course, this FAU team. And he was an assistant in Florida before coming to FAU. And like I said, what he's done, this is a team, and it's not that improbable, because they're shooting over 36% from three for the season, which has been huge to them winning. So I think the combination of the coaching and the three-point shooting is what's going to get this done for them, especially if they have a chance to go on. And FAU, they also hold their opponents to, I think this is right, 27% or so shooting from the three-point line. So they can defend the three as well. Now, I mean, just to show you just how crazy it is, and the last time that I recorded this podcast, it was almost 2 weeks ago already, just feeling down in the dumps about Arizona, how I'm never going to get a chance to see this team win a national championship or a Final Four. And FAU is just, you know, yet again, another one of these improbable teams to make it. Butler 2010, 2011, VCU 2011, Wichita State 2013, Loyola Chicago in 2018, even Gonzaga I'm putting in there 2017, 2021. They had already been established at that time, but teams from, you know, lower conferences, not the Pac-12, not the Big East, the SEC, you know, the Power Five plus the Big East. And even schools from those Power Five conferences like South Carolina in 2017, Auburn in 2019, those aren't basketball powers. South Carolina is really not even that good at football, but Auburn is definitely a football school. So, I mean, again, if you're an Arizona alum like me, you're sitting there after I just read off this list of teams and you're just disgusted that this team can't get it done. But this is not about Arizona. Now, from San Diego State side, they play at a very slow pace. They want to keep the game, you know, in the 50s, as you saw in that Elite Eight game. So, I mean, they're from the Mountain West. And it's not as surprising because they were a 5 seed, but last year the Mountain West didn't even win a tournament game. So it is, from that angle, pretty surprising. Now, my picks for the game there, I like San Diego State laying the 1.5. I think that San Diego State's defense should keep FAU in check. So I like that. It's a pretty small number to cover. And to talk about UConn, they're obviously the favorite. But if you're looking at Miami, again, not really a traditional. They're in the Final Four. I should have included them in this list. They're, you know, a football school historically. Not that they've been that great lately, but they're a football school, absolutely not a basketball school. And Miami was able to score 88 points in their last game, and they only had 2 3-pointers. So this is a team that doesn't necessarily need to rely on the three. And when I was looking, you know, at the beginning of the tournament, when I broke it down with my buddy Budish, I said I liked about Arizona, why I picked them to win it all, I guess, by default, not just because I graduated from there, but I liked that they didn't rely on the three-pointer. So that's what you have to like about Miami. And, of course, Larrañaga, he's an amazing story. You got to love him. He's been to 2 Final Fours now, first with George Mason, who was really the original Cinderella story. I mean, George Mason was led by a 6'5" power forward, Jai Lewis, listed at 6'7" in college, but then he actually signed with my New York Football Giants, yes, in the NFL, to try to play football, try to make it as a pass-blocking left tackle. And, you know, they measured him at 6'5". So Larrañaga has been doing this with lower-level talent, of course, at George Mason, getting them to a Final Four. And now last year, Miami, he took the Elite Eight. This year, they're in the Final Four. So you got to love that this is a guy who's 73 years old, still young feeling, going about it, doing his best, and he's got his team in the Final Four. And one more thing about the tournament as a whole, and then I'll give you a pick on the UConn-Miami game. This tournament absolutely always delivers. It's a blast to watch. I like having the games, you know, that first weekend kind of all day, Thursday, Friday, even a little bit once you start Saturday and Sunday, all afternoon, all night. I love that about it. It's just consistent action at a time in the, you know, the sports calendar where you absolutely need it. So it delivers every single year. It's always great. I didn't used to think that, but the more and more I look at it, it's always great. It's always entertaining. You're either going to get, you know, sometimes you get these Cinderellas like FAU and even San Diego State. But even other times you get blue bloods like last year. You get Villanova, you get Duke, you get North Carolina. So I think that it's all, and Kansas, of course, who won it. It's always great, no matter which way. And people say that they don't like these Cinderellas. But again, I'm okay with it in this Final Four because you have FAU versus San Diego State. And I think with the UConn-Miami game, I think I'm going to go with UConn laying the 5.5 because they've just been so dominant. I know this is, you know, the least sharp thing you're ever going to hear me say, but they've just been so dominant. They can score in so many different ways. They got multiple bigs. So give me UConn. So we're going to have UConn and San Diego State in the championship game, and that'll be a fun game, I think, next Monday. All right, the next topic. Let's transition here to baseball because, of course, college basketball runs right into baseball. And let's just start with the rule changes. I think the rule changes, they're going to make the games more fun. The one rule change I would have not put in was you can only throw over twice if you're the pitcher. It's going to lead to catchers throwing behind the runner, which can be exciting. But I just think that, you know what, you got to let the guys on the field be able to operate, and you shouldn't be moving too much away from some of the, you know, original rules of the game. I'm okay with the pitch clock. I'm okay with the batter needing to stay in the box because I do think that helps speed up the flow, makes it more exciting when you're at the game, makes it more exciting when you're watching at home. It'll take up less time because, like, it's impossible to go hang out with people and say that you're going to go watch a game because if you tell your significant other at home or if you got kids, you don't know how long you're going to be, and it's too much. So I like those rules, but I don't think that throwing over a million times is what's really slowing it up. And the shift. I love this. I used to think, okay, when teams were shifting, and they shifted about 35% of the time last year, which just goes to show you the, you know, smart analytics of it. But I used to think that, why don't these guys learn to bunt down? But let's just say that they did that, okay? Now we got guys bunting, you know, these big power guys who you want to see swing the bat because even if they're not hitting out of the ballpark, they're hitting a hard line drive. And I don't think bunting the ball is really exciting. So I like what they did. I like that you can't have, you know, guys back on the outfield grass till after the ball's pitched. I think that that'll make it a little bit easier to get more hits. I think hits are a lot more exciting. I think, you know, the ball goes right between first base and second base. I think that's a lot more exciting having it go into the outfield as opposed to a simple 4-3 put out. Maybe that's just me, but I think it'll lead to much more exciting games, much more exciting plays. I think that, you know, some of the most exciting stuff is honestly watching the right fielder trying to throw out a guy at third after he's trying to take an extra base on a single. It was getting moved over. Still think that remains in the mix. And I think if you have more guys putting the ball on bat, it'll continue to keep the game flowing and keep it exciting for people out there. All right. Now, as far as the sport itself, there is a whole bunch of teams that honestly, in Major League Baseball, there's not even a point of them playing. I mean, we're going to go through it right now, division by division, and I'm going to tell you whether or not they should even bother showing up for opening day. All right, let's start with the AL Central. The Tigers and the Royals, they can stay home. There's two right there. There's not even any point of them showing up. They're not going to win more than 70 games. AL East, honestly, I think every team is okay. They're good enough. And Baltimore Orioles, you wouldn't have been able to say this going into last year, but they have enough exciting things going on. So I'm at two teams. In the West, Oakland shouldn't even bother, so I'm at three. I mean, the Angels, they're going to win 80 games if they're lucky. I've never seen a team squander so much talent. So I've got three in the AL. So I might be overstating in the AL, but let's look at the NL because it's really ugly. Reds, Pirates, don't even bother. There's two more. We're at five. Marlins, don't even bother. Nationals, especially, don't even bother. So we are at three in the AL, two in the NL Central gives us five. Two more in the NL East gives us seven. And in the West, Rockies, that's eight, don't even bother. So that is eight teams. That's a lot. It's more than a quarter of the sport. And that's me being generous, quite frankly, because I think the argument can be made, honestly, even for the Cubs, if things don't go the right way, the Giants, maybe the D-backs. It's rough to just essentially say, like, what's the point of even showing up for some of these teams? But they don't stand a chance, and a lot of them aren't even trying to win, or you know they're going to trade off players. Like if you're Pittsburgh, you're going to trade off Brian Reynolds. I mean, Cincinnati, they're paying Joey Votto almost so much money, it really limits what they can do. What, and he's aged, not quite, doesn't really have any power anymore. So what's the point for those teams of showing up? But as far as, you know, I got to give you the old school Mike and the Mad Dog over unders. I used to do six. I'm going to do five just so we can have either a winning record or a losing record. But let's do the overs. The Cubs at 76.5. Last year, they had the most bullpen losses in Major League Baseball. Stroman ran into all sorts of bad luck, and you can look at all sorts of advanced pitching metrics that I don't need to get into right now, but that'll tell you he was pretty good. You have Kendricks in there, of course. Even Drew Smyly had a reasonable ERA at the back end of their rotation. So they've got enough pitching, I think, and the number 76.5. And I hate to look at teams in this spot where they're in the 70s because you're not really taking a strong position and saying the team's going to be good or the team's going to be bad. But I think that the Cubs, while I don't agree with what they're doing and some of the players that they're bringing in, because I think it's a trip straight to mediocrity, which is just a place you don't want to be at in sports. I mean, take a look in the NBA. The Washington Wizards have been mediocre for two decades. It stinks when, you know, you're trying to build something, but you're not really all in to spend the type of money or keep your players that you already had. And the Cubs are on a one-way ticket to mediocrity, but I think mediocrity will get us home to the window here because it's only 76.5. The lineup, it's okay. I like Happ. He's a good professional hitter. They bring in Swanson on a pretty big deal. But again, this is what I'm saying. They're bringing in a good shortstop. And you'd think that when you sign a guy like that, you'd have other players in place to maybe make him the last guy on the team that's going to help you win. But they're striving for mediocrity. What can I say? But Swanson's hit over 25 home runs the past two seasons. You got Bellinger on a prove-it deal, former MVP, to see if he can bounce back. I think he'll do a little bit better. I could see him hitting maybe 230, maybe getting on base 325, hitting 25 home runs. So I think he'll be productive if he does that. Hosmer's still a major leaguer. He can still get on base at about a 34% clip. Never really had much power to begin with, but he's a good major leaguer with a good enough glove over there, first base. They brought in a guy from the Dodgers named Rios who had 7 homers and 86 at-bats. Been a part-timer for the Dodgers since 2019. So, you know, maybe you can translate that into some pop. And you look even over at second base with Nico Hoerner, and this is a guy that hit over 280 last year. And, you know, maybe they've got enough. Again, we're not even saying that they have to have a winning record, but can they win 77 games? I don't think that that's inconceivable. So give us the Cubs over 76.5. Continuing with this trend, the Arizona Diamondbacks. This team was 19-31 last year in one run or extra inning games. They won 74 this year. I'm not saying 74 games is good because it's not. But again, look where the number is. And if you have somewhat of a reversal of last year, if you go 21-29 in those games, you know, that puts you at 76 wins. They have some legitimate starters with Gallen and Kelly, and maybe even Ryan Nelson will make an impact as a starter. As a former second-round pick who had a 1.47 ERA last year with a small sample size. You have to love some of these young outfielders like Corbin Carroll, who they just signed to a pretty big extension. And the Diamondbacks, if you know anything about them, they don't extend anyone. They don't re-up anyone. They are a horrendous organization, and I lived there for, you know, 15 years. So if anyone could tell you about the Diamondbacks, it's probably me. And I was even a partial season ticket holder for the Diamondbacks. So if anyone knows that organization, it's me. So, you know, you got Corbin Carroll, you got Jake McCarthy, and Christian Walker quietly last year hit 36 home runs. So it's not like they're decrepit of talent. I like Rojas. This is a guy who's going to lead off. He's a super utility guy. He played some second base and third base, but he's played the outfield before. And he's going to give you some nice speed. He had 23 steals last year in 443 at-bats. So I like, you know, maybe a slightly larger role for him, show what he can do. Pretty reasonable on base. I think he got a base about 36% of the time for a 360 clip. So I think this is not a team that's decrepit of, you know, any talent. And if they're able to have some effective pitching like they did last year, I'm just going to look up the team ERA here last year. But, you know, they have Merrill Kelly who started that big WBC game. So if you have guys on the team who are good enough, I mean, yeah, maybe they've got a shot, honestly, to get to that over 75 and a half. So, and we're looking up this Diamondback ERA. I swear, it makes it so hard to find things anymore. Let's see. Diamondback ERA last year was 4.25, so not as good as I thought. But they've got some pitchers. They've got enough there where I think they can get to 76 wins. All right, and the last over, and I hate how much I love this one. It's the Houston Astros over 95 and a half. Since 2017, and you can throw out the COVID year, they've won at least 95 and a half games every single year except for 2021, where they won 95 games. I know Verlander's gone, but people love Christian Javier, and we saw what he did against the Yankees in the playoffs. We saw what he did in the World Series. Framber Valdez, people love him. And they're always just throwing out pitchers. They're even going to bring out a guy named Hunter Brown. He's a 24-year-old. He can throw three pitches for strikes, induces a lot of ground balls. He throws a 93-mile-an-hour slider last year. That was his average slider velocity. He was out of the bullpen, but, you know, maybe he tones it down a little and he's throwing 91, 92 with the slider. And Houston constantly replaces pitchers. I mean, Cole leaves, Morton leaves, Verlander leaves. Doesn't matter. They're at least in the ALCS every year since 2017. They won 106 last year. So even if they give 10 back, we're heading to the window. And this leads me to a little bit of a transition here. I hate the Houston Astros. I think as a Yankee fan, I now hate the Astros more than the Boston Red Sox, which is just absolutely unbelievable. I never thought that I would say that in my entire life. In my entire life. Just unbelievable. All right, and then let's get to these unders. We got two of them. The Mariners, 86 and a half. I know people are into the Mariners. They made the playoffs last year for the first time since 2001, the great 2001 Seattle Mariner team. Do you remember them? Because I certainly do. But I sense some regression based on their record in one-run games last year. They were 36 and 24. That would play out to a 600 clip, a 60 winning percentage. So I see them taking a step back. I'm not going to tell you they're going to be under 500 again. But I think if they win 86 games, I'm not going to be surprised, and you're safe. And then the last team that we're going to touch on here, and then we'll wrap it up, and we'll save the Knicks for another time. But last team we're going to talk about here is the Washington Nationals. This is a horrible team, okay? There's no other way of putting it. Patrick Corbin, who wanted to come to the Yankees in 2019, thank goodness he didn't, he's cooked. He's had about a 6 ERA the last 2 years, and it's not because he's only pitched a few innings. He pitches a lot of innings. He's on there just to eat innings, and he's making a fortune. Josiah Gray, he's supposed to be a young and up-and-coming pitcher for them. He had more than a strikeout per inning last year. Seems great, right? But he had a 5 ERA. I can't kill them for the decline because, honestly, this is a team that pushed all their chips to the table in 2019, and they won a World Series. That's less than 4 years ago. I never would have traded Soto in a million years, but you got enough prospects where you can rebuild. This is just a dreadful lineup with no one above a 324 on base percentage, and no one last year hit more than 23 home runs. Under 55 and a half. They only won 55 last year. I think this is a great play too. All right, Schloss Rant. Live from the Philadelphia suburbs. We got opening day on Thursday. We got the Final Four this weekend. We got the Masters. And I just saw a text from my buddy Brown Bear, Miguel. We're going to probably do a Masters preview show at some point next week. So, Schloss Rant, enjoy the Final Four. Enjoy opening day on Thursday. Let's go Yankees. And good luck to anyone who's still alive in any of those bracket challenges. Schloss Rant, Philly suburbs. We'll see you later, everyone.